are articles which I wrote for the Stoner Gazette, the first of which appeared on 19th May 1991. There were four articles as follows. Most, if not all, crofting communities in the Western Isles are affected by unemployment and depopulation as a degree. While there are undoubtedly many crofting communities in the islands and islands that are vibrant, alive and progressive, unfortunately there are many others that have suffered serious depopulation because of the lack of employment within reasonable travelling distance. Some of these deprived crofting communities are so fragile that there is a distinct danger that many of them may eventually become completely depopulated and revert back to a wilderness unless urgent steps are taken to revive the local economy and the quality of community and social life. In an attempt to illustrate the gravity of the situation, we have carried out a study of the district of Park, which is one of the deprived crofting communities in Lewis. That district is situated about 30 miles south of Stornoway, and it consists of 10 crofting townships. Park is said to have been the last large area in Lewis to be extensively populated. The ancestors of the present population of Park settled there towards the end of the 18th and the early 19th centuries, at a time when the population of Lewis was rising very fast. In 1755, there were only 6,368 people in Lewis, but in the 76 years that followed, the population increased by 127%, and in 1831 it stood at 14,541 people. It was during that period that the whole of the Park Peninsula was populated, albeit somewhat sparsely to begin with. During the next 70 years to the beginning of the 20th century, the population of both Park and the whole of Lewis grew rapidly. Park to 1,882 and over 29,000 in Lewis as a whole. The early settlers at Park went about the business of earning their living by their own initiative, without any assistance from anyone, but unfortunately they were not left alone for long. The clearance that began in the southern tip of the peninsula in the opening years of the 19th century, when the Park sheep farm was established at Valamas, eventually cleared the crofter from 2/3 or 42,000 acres of the land surface of the peninsula. In 1886, the sheep farm, which was no longer viable, was converted into a sporting deer park for the affluent reach from the industrial south. It is still a deer park today. George Mackenzie Laxey was one of those who referred to the park clearances in his evidence to the Napier Commission when he said that his own and other families were, and I quote, "driven from our agreeable holdings on which we knew nothing beyond prosperity and happiness. Park, which nature seemed to mean for man, with all its arable land, hill pastures and bays of the sea, offered grand opportunities for comfort as a reward for human industry, but was quite unprecedentedly relieved of the inhabitant population of 28 townships." Unquote. When the park clearances eased towards the middle of the 19th century, the remaining crofters were huddled together in the 12 fishing townships in the northern part of the peninsula, extending to 26,000 acres, including the common grazing. That area is still under crofting. The settlers were attracted to Perk originally because of the excellent economic prospects in the area towards the end of the 18th century, making it one of the most attractive areas in Lewis to live in at that time. Kelping, the conversion of seaweed into alkali, was a prosperous industry in the islands at that time, and the sheltered bays and sea lochs of Perk were eminently suitable for harvesting seaweed. The same bays and anchorages were quite equally suitable for fishing, as were the offshore banks, which were teeming with all kinds of fish suitable for both domestic and commercial fishing. There was also plenty of land available, and the hills of Perk afforded good shelter for the crofter's stock, enabling them to outwit their hardy highland cattle, on which the economy of the highlands and islands depended to a large extent at that time. Their flocks of sheep provided mutton for the table and wool for clothing and blanketing. In that way, the early settlers of Perk, as in all parts of Lewis, engaged in crofting agriculture as well as some other form of ancillary employment, such as kelping, fishing, etc., etc. Hence, the location of their settlements were governed by easy access to the sea, because it was from the sea, in large measure, that they derived the substance of their livelihood. Although there were no roads anywhere in Perk in the 19th century, the place was not considered remote because it was boats that the people used in the way cars are used nowadays. There were plenty of suitable anchorages and sheltered bays in Perk for the boat people. 1 hour's run in a stiff breeze would bring the man of Perk in his sailing boat into Stornoway, the main port and fishing market in the island. The early settlers in Perk were therefore reasonably well off once they built homes for themselves and carved landholdings out of the virgin moorland. To begin with, Perk was under the old Runrig land system of communal tenure. But the new crofting system of tenure, setting out individual crofts, came in the early part of the 19th century. The Seaforth landlord followed the usual pattern of deliberately keeping part-time crofts as small as possible so that the crofters would be forced to supplement their meagre return from the land by working for the landlord as cheap labour on his profitable kelping activities. When the kelping industry failed, the crofters of Perk relied mainly on the fishing industry, which was a growth industry for the whole of the 19th century, providing work for hundreds of men and women. However, the herring fishing never recovered after the First World War, and in the absence of some other form of remunerative employment, the people were forced to emigrate in search of work. And that process continued throughout the whole of the 20th century. The overall picture that emerges from a study of population trends is of a steady rise in numbers during the whole of the 19th century, when there was ancillary work for the crofters locally. As the ancillary work declined, there was a dramatic decline in the population during the 20th century, until population numbers came full circle in the space of 200 years. That is, 200 years ago, there was just as few people in Perk as there is now. Crofting is based on part-time agriculture together with some other form of employment. Crofting agriculture alone will not and never did sustain crofting families. The key to stabilizing a healthy crofting community is sufficient auxiliary employment. Indeed, in the present day, crofting agriculture has become a source of supplementary income for the crofter. If we take the 12 northern townships that were continuously settled throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, we see a drop in population from a peak of 2,243 people to the present 443. The number of crofters in the area, the number of crofts in the area is 224. This leaves us with an average of 2 people per croft today. In 1911, there were more people in the one village of Graver, where there were 468 people, than there is in the whole of Park at present. 3 of the 12 townships are completely depopulated. That is Crubbick, Steamroway and Calbost. Steamroway, which was cleared in 1858 and land raided again in 1921, was never acknowledged by the Department of Agriculture as a crofting township, although some families remained there until their young folk were called up on active service during the Second World War. At one time, Graver, like all the other villages of Park, was grossly overcrowded. In 1891, a group of landless cotters from Graver land raided Steamroway, but they were denied the land of that former crofting township, as was the other folk that was with them from the other villages, and they were cast in prison in Inverness. Landless families from Graver began to move out to the common grazing at Glenside Graver about 1924, and 10 years later the Department of Agriculture was persuaded to establish 15 small holdings at Glenside, but as usual it was too late, too little and too late. 2 of the holdings, 9 and 14, were never taken up, but the original 13 families that settled at Glenside comprised of over 90 people. Today there are only 9 people, 8 of them elderly, living permanently in the 5 houses that are occupied on Glenside Graver. The Glenside resettlement scheme marked the end of nearly a century and a half of population redistribution in the Park Peninsula. Now that's the end of the first article, except that I'm make the point that there are 2 tables or graphs in this article. The first one giving the population of all the townships from Happis, Kirster, Kirrawarra right across to Eeskin from 1830 to 1990. And the other one is a graph showing the number of crofts, the peak population and the present population of each of the villages. Thank you. We now come to the second of the 4 articles in the Stornoway Gazette, the article dated 25th May 1991, A Crofting District, the Rise and Fall of Park. And this one refers to the early school population. After the passing of the 1872 Education Act, the Lochs School Board decided to build 5 new primary schools in Park. account was taken of all the prospective pupils in the age group of 5 to 13 years old in the district in December 1873. The five catchment areas, school catchment areas, show a total of 416 children. In the Carter school catchment area, 73 children were of school age. This included Harpast, Carter, Kerrigard and Caberstein. In the Cremorne area, there were 61 pupils from Cremorne, Crubbick and Thurrestein. While in the Planisker area, there were 98. And these 98 came from Marwick and Carlos. Graver's 83 pupils and Lemroy's 101 completed the total school roll of 416. We have a graph here on this article giving these details with the number in each village. Harpast 25, Kirster 20, Kerrigard 18, Caberstein 10, Cremorne 52, Crubbick 2, Thurrestein 4, Marwick 57, Caldbus 41, Graver 83 and Lemroy 101. There were nearly as many children in Park in that one age group as in the whole population of Park, totalling 443. That is 403 people in Park. Indeed, the total population of Park in 1873 was 1,573. This continued to rise for 40 years more until it peaked in 1911 at 1,882 people. All five primary schools in Park eventually averaged over 100 pupils in each school. Each of them was a three-teacher school. The first one in 1878, and 3 years later, the last of the five schools that Lemroy had started teaching. The schools were all built near the shore, since roads had not yet reached Park at that time. Park's five schools were all built under a single contract for the Loughs School Board, and the contractor was Alexander MacDonald of Lynedale, Isle of Skye, who was paid £13,325 for the five schools at Park. Another four schools were built in North Loughs. The dwelling houses were included, dwelling houses attached to the school. Over 100 years later, all these school buildings are still in fairly good condition, and very little was ever spent on their upkeep, except that bathrooms were installed in the dwelling houses for the first time in the 1920s. Probably each one of these buildings are worth more now than it cost to build all nine of them in the 1870s. In the meantime, many hundreds of people owe a great deal to these buildings, and the good men and women who taught in them over the years. It was a good communal investment which earned a handsome dividend. Eventually, there were 12 schools together with their dwelling houses in Loughs. That is, in the whole of Loughs, north and south. 5 in South Loughs and 7 in North Loughs, built at a cost of £20,300. For some unknown reason, the powers that be graced the Marwick School with the name Planisker School. It seems that the name derives like Blar Inyestui, which sounded like Planisker to the non-Gaelic speakers here. Lar is a field or level piece of ground. Estu, or black waterfall, is the waterfall on the stream to the south of the school. The humorists of Maravik naturally thought of an alternative explanation to the name of their school. They maintained that a certain character in Maravik persistently asked the builder about the plan for the school. Eventually, they dubbed him the Plan Askar. By the 1960s, some 80 years after the schools at Park were opened, the population of the district had fallen below the level that could justify the continued use of five schools. It was therefore decided by Rothancromarty Education Authority to replace all five schools with a new purpose-built primary school at Grammar. The new school was opened in 1973 by a former pupil of Plan Askar, Air Force Group Captain Reverend Dr. Murdo Kennedy MacLeod of Calbost. The opening roll at that time stood at 50 pupils, with three local teachers on the staff. The head was Mr. Kenneth MacLeod of Calbost, assisted by Mrs. Ishbel McInnes of Grammer and Miss Mary MacLeod of Cromwell. The cost of the school was estimated at £190,000. The Park School roll had dropped then from some 500 or 600 at the turn of the century to 50 in 1973. In the intervening years since the new school was opened, the roll has continued its downward slide, and today it stands at 26 pupils. If it was not for the incoming families arriving in recent years, the figures would be even lower. Now, we have two graphs on this page, one of them digging in the age structure and the language of the whole population, and it is quite interesting, and the other digs in all the villages as usual in Park, and the children under age, under school age, like primary school children, secondary school children, college students, and the total altogether, and total children is 67. Perhaps the best way to judge the viability of any community is to look at the age structure and numbers of the rising population. A survey of Park reveals that of the 67 children and young people in the district, 11 are under school age. There are 26 primary school children, 22 secondary school children, and 3 college students. However, in Harpost, Calbost, Lemdway, and Orensey, there are no school children, while another 4 villages only have 1 preschool child. In these circumstances, it is likely that the district may decline still further unless families are attracted back to Park by gainful employment, or school leavers find remunerative employment in the area and settle there, raising children. The only reason that the figures for Grammer, 5 preschool children, 9 primary children, 6 secondary and 1 college student, the reason for that being somewhat higher is that a number of incoming families with children have settled there recently. It is a well-known fact that because of aging and consequent depopulation in some of the Western Isles, remote crofting townships, this has led to difficulties in mustering enough able-bodied men to do the sheep roundup on the more distant parts of the common grazing, there are similar difficulties in many crofting communities with all forms of communal work when townships fall below a certain level of viability. It is then that serious disintegration sets in. In the case of Park, we feel that it might be useful to examine the present age structure as well as the drift away from the Gaelic, language. And we see that in there's a table 4 here, giving various figures for that. Throughout Park, 42% of the population are over 60 years old. This imbalance in the senior citizen group is the most striking feature of the population profiling. If we split the population into two groups, only 112 souls are under 30 years. That's against 331 people above that age. Leaving aside the senior citizens and the school children, there are only 189 men and women between the ages of 17 and 60 years, which is an average of about 10 men and women of working age in each of the 9 townships in Park. The 10th township, Calbert, is already dead, and the youngest person in Limerway is well over 30 years old. The more serious question is how many of the 67 children now at school will be able to find work in or near the district with their eventual qualifications and skills. To say the least, the prospect of work for the young within or near the district in the present economic situation is bleak. By any standard, Park is then a very fragile district that requires urgent attention from the authorities. As a crofting district, it is reasonable to ask, what is the Crofters Commission doing to implement their third heading of their remit, which is, quote, to promote the interests of crofters, unquote. And that is the end of the second article. And we now come to the third article, which is in the Stornoway Gazette, which is dated 1st of June, a crofting district, rise and fall of Park. And here we look at the viability of the crofting community. Now we start with Limerway, headed Limerway. The situation in Limerway, the second largest village in Park, with 33 crofts, deserves to be highlighted. Its case is illustrative of the way all Park's villages are going. In Limerway, the population stood at 339 in 1911. Today, it has dropped to 41. The panoramic view from the hill above the township as one approaches on the road is quite magnificent. So much so that many people stop their cars as they survey the view over the hills of Park, the Shandines and across the sky, with Limerway and Oranse nestling below on the shores of Loch Shell. As a casual visitor surveys the trim, well-kept, whitewashed houses of Limerway, he would never guess the extent of the deprivation in the township. If we exclude the 8 people living in local authority houses, we are left with about 33 people living on the 33 crofts, the youngest of whom is 35 years old. Of the others, all except 8 are senior citizens. There are 14 houses in Limerway with only one inhabitant. During the last few years, Limerway has lost about a third of its population through death. Although some of the crofts are now unoccupied, they are worked by neighbouring crofters. How did a deprived crofting community like Limerick cope with the extra burden of the poll tax? In the first year of the tax, 1988-89, the people of Limerick were called upon to pay an extra £4,480, more than they would have paid under the old rating system. In the following year, they were called upon to pay £4,794, more than they would have paid under the old rating system. So between these 2 years, there was over £9,000 they had to pay extra. This penal taxation was certainly hastening the end of deprived crofting communities like Barrick. For many years, Limerick on its own supported a three-teacher school. When the children were counted in 1873, that is when the Education Act, First Education Act of 1872 was passed, in anticipation of the building of new schools, Limerick was the only school in Park, in Park's five catchment areas, to muster over 100 children between the age of 5 and 13 years. At that time, the population in Limerick stood at about 236. In 1911, it had risen steadily to 339. And we may be sure that the number of village children rose correspondingly. The children of Oranse only came to Limerick School in the 1920s when Oranse was repopulated by landless Limerick families. The township of Limerick also sustained a church congregation of its own, and in the 1960s they built a magnificent new church and manse. For most of the last 200 years, the sheltered anchorage of Limerick was full of large offshore boats, with about 6 people crew in each vessel. We recall that in the 1930s there were 9 large offshore fishing boats in Limerick, providing work for over 50 men. There was a Kaibok Head, built before the First World War as a sailing boat for a Limerick crew. It was among the first fishing boats to be fitted with a paraffin engine after the First World War. Then there was the Rose, the Ocean Searcher, Flora Smith, Chrysolite, Stella Matina, Olive Branch, Bluebell, and Daisy. There were also smaller lobster boats as well. After the Second World War, Limerick led the island in modern fishing technology when the Macmillan brothers acquired the first and only purpose-built ring net fishing boat in Lewis, the Isabella. The original people of Limerick were cleared and replaced with sheep in 1843. The village remained part of the Park Sheep Farm for about 16 years until the crofters were cleared from Steamerway in 1858 and permitted to occupy Limerway on the edge of the sheep farm. Most of the original people of Limerway settled in Crossopost in 1843, and the rest of them are scattered to various places throughout the island. Now, patriotism in Park. The recently published Second World War Roll of Honour, compiled by the Historical Society for Park, shows the names of 361 servicemen and women, which was nearly a quarter of the entire population of 1,482 persons living in Park in 1941. Incidentally, The book is a bargain of the year at £5 plus postage for a historical pictorial of 322 photos of local young people. No local household should be with a copy as a record for posterity. The book shows quite a number of families with four or five sons in the firing line, such as the MacKinnon family from 24 Marwick, Clondre the Herry, who lost two of the five brothers in active service. There are at least two families with eight men and women listed, such as 12 Calbost, Glady, 12 Calbost, and Shawnee and Ursh at 40 Carver. The district made a similar contribution for the First World War when the promises of a land fit for heroes rung in their ears, only to find unemployment and emigrant ships waiting for them at the end of the war, and an interim interdict for the ex-service landraiders of Steamroy and Ordnance who had defiantly cut their names in the turf of these former crofting villages. At the end of the Second World War, the men and women of Park were forced to protest with their feet because of the lack of remunerative employment. The extreme deprivation of Park is a challenge to HEI, that's Highland Enterprise, and LEC, Local Enterprise Company, Colin Yellen, the Crofting Commission, etc. And the situation requires initiative from these bodies, not just waiting for local entrepreneurial schemes, because many of the enterprising folk were forced to leave the district long ago. Crofter fishermen. Traditionally, the people of Park were mainly crofter fishermen, and although these two industries are complementary, Providence decreed that from time to time there was failure either in the harvest of the sea or the harvest of the land. At such times, people were usually able to fall back on one or other of these two industries as an insurance against destitution. At one time, almost the total working population of Park, totaling hundreds of men and women, were engaged in the fishing industry. Following it round the east and west coast of Scotland, as well as East Anglia, the Isle of Man, and Ireland. Nowadays, the number of people who are engaged in the sea fishing industry in Park is only about a dozen, and almost all of them are in Marwick and Cremorne. Fortunately, however, an unexpected new kind of fishing sprung up in Park in recent years in the form of fish farming. This employs about 30 people locally, including about half a dozen women. Surprisingly, that is nearly three times as many people as are engaged in the sea fishing at present. There are about a dozen weavers engaged in the hardweed industry, some of them part-time, but fishing remains the main source of local employment, along with part-time crofting, which makes the area quite vulnerable should there be a recession in the fishing for any reason. A local community cooperative has made a valuable contribution to the economy of the area in recent years. Tourism is not a significant feature of the economy of Park. Look at the Gaelic language now. Much is done now for the preservation of the Gaelic language. Let us hope that it is not too late. We must be realistic, though, and look at the situation as it really is. Until comparatively recently, everyone in Park was fully bilingual, but nearly one-third of the population is now solely English-speaking, or at least not proficient in Gaelic. There are now only 8 fluent Gaelic-speaking children in Berwick. But it is only fair to point out that a substantial number of the other 59 children understand Gaelic reasonably well. They reply in English when addressed in Gaelic because they are not accustomed to speaking Gaelic in normal conversation and lack the confidence to make an attempt at speaking. It would appear that some Gaelic-speaking parents do not teach or speak to their children in the language in any meaningful way. Should a Gaelic lobby be aiming at the parents as well as the children? A survey of Park shows that 13 families have 2 Gaelic-speaking parents. Another 12 have 1 Gaelic-speaking parent, while another 11 are solely English-speaking. There are, as we have seen, 8 fluent Gaelic-speaking children, while 59 children are English-speaking only. While Colin Gillan is to be congratulated for their efforts to revive the Gaelic language, one must ask if their policy is effective. Is it half-hearted and complacent? We note that some senior councillors and others who are qualified to evaluate the Colin's Gaelic policy are very critical of the results achieved to date. There is no reason to suppose that Gaelic in the rest of the Western Isles, hitherto the bastion of the language, is in any better position than in Park. If not, it requires a very determined effort on the part of both parents and the education system to restore the language. Let us hope that our valuable heritage is not lost through our own neglect while we quibble about limited resources and priorities. The strange thing is that perceptive people all over the country and further afield are clamouring to learn and preserve the Gaelic language, while we in Lewis are neglecting to speak or teach it to our children. The present-day church in Lewis also seems to be in a hurry to turn its back on preaching in Gaelic, through which we received our valuable religious heritage. Now on this page there is a lovely view of Lameroy showing Illanuard right across to the island of Skye, and there is also a table giving the parents and children and the Gaelic language, with the townships listed on the left hand side, and the headings on the table is, the first heading is both parents Gaelic speaking, that's 13 couples. One parent Gaelic speaking, that's 12 couples. And both parents English speaking, that's 11 couples. So the parents are divided 3 ways equally, at 11 or 12 in each of the 3 categories. Then the fourth column is fluent Gaelic speaking children, and that comes to 8. Now the English speaking children comes to 59, and the total number of children comes to 67. And this table gives the number in each village as well. And that is the end of the third of the 4 articles. And we now go into the fourth and last article in the Astronomy Gazette, and this one is week ending June 8, 1991. A crofting district, it is headed, The Rise and Fall of Park. Now, this one is the need for a global strategy. This series of articles on the history of the crofting district of Park over the past two centuries shows an urgent need for economic regeneration both in Park and in similar deprived crofting areas if we are to have healthy crofting communities in the Highlands and Islands. Without doubt, the main contributing factor in depopulation and decline in crofting areas is the lack of work. It is therefore a matter of very great concern to everyone living in the Highlands and Islands as to whether the available resources are used. We now come to the fourth and last of these four articles I wrote for the Astronomy Gazette, and this one is dated week ending June 8th, 1991. We started reading this article at the end of the other side of the tape, but we will start at the beginning once again. The articles are called A Crofting District, The Rise and Fall of Park, and this particular fourth article is headed The Need for a Global Strategy. Angus MacLeod. In this series of articles on the history of the crofting district of Park over the past two centuries shows an urgent need for economic regeneration both in Park and in similar deprived crofting districts if we are to have healthy crofting communities in the Highlands and Islands. Without doubt, the main contributing factor in depopulation and decline in crofting areas is the lack of work. It is therefore a matter of a very great concern to everyone living in the Highlands and Islands as to whether the available resources are used effectively and whether the various bodies operating in the Highlands are functioning in a coordinated and efficient manner. Crofting is a highly integrated industry, a way of life involving not only agriculture but also, of necessity, some other kind of additional work. This was acknowledged by the Taylor Commission of Inquiry into Crofting Conditions in a report of 1954. as well as the Crofters Commission in their 1959 annual report, pardon me, one of their first reports. The Crofters Commission stated in that report, I quote, without additional sources of income, agriculture by itself cannot, in our opinion, support viable crofting communities in many crofting areas, unquote. Considering that the concept of crofting is a duality of agriculture together with some other form of ancillary employment, it surely makes sense that the remit of the Crofters Commission, which is the main governing body for crofting, should cover both agriculture and economic development. Now, so, in fact, the responsibility for the welfare of the crofting community at present is divided between a variety of public bodies, each of which is working in complete isolation from the others without any global integrated development strategy or even any meaningful coordination or coherent approach to the problems of the crofting community. These public bodies in the Highlands evolved in a haphazard manner over the years with overlaps as well as gaps in their responsibilities. Has the time come to review the functions of the various government bodies? The Crofters Commission is restricted by its remit to a narrow interpretation of matters relating to crofting agriculture only, and because of that, it is quite unable to contribute anything towards the most essential aspect of crofting, which nowadays is not agriculture, but ancillary employment. Without this, crofters are unable to remain on their crofts. Social and economic matters are the responsibility of the Highlands and Islands Enterprise, HIE, which took over this year from the HIDB, Highlands and Islands Development Board. The HIDB was not set up until 1966, some 10 years after the Crofters Commission. So during that period, there was no development in the Highlands, no development body in the Highlands. And surely they ought to have given these powers to the Crofters Commission at that time. Now, responsibility for the welfare of the crofting community is therefore divided in the first place between the Commission and the HIE, but also between a variety of other public bodies such as the Department of Agriculture and Fisheries, DAFS, the Sea Fish Authority, Colin Yellan, Scottish Homes, and so on, etc. That situation led many people in the past to suggest that the Crofters Commission should be incorporated into the HIDB as a separate division in order to work out integrated development policies for all aspects of crofting. New body. In the meantime, events have moved on and the government has adopted a new policy for the Highlands and Islands by introducing HIE. Under the new body are a brood of 10 local enterprise companies, LECs, local enterprise companies, who are responsible for directing, designing and delivering enterprise development, training, environmental and social projects and services in their respective areas, to quote Scottish Office launch publicity. According to the Scottish Office, the LECs will operate within a policy framework set by HIE. Each of these 10 new LECs, LECs, companies, may have anything between 7 and 12 appointed directors as well as staff. The maximum amount they may consider for any one development is £15,000, which is, strangely to say, the same amount as was previously within the disposal of the local offices of the HIDP in Stornoway and other places. The main functions of LECs, LECs, are development and training. But we understand that the resources available for training for the first year of the Western Isles LEC fall far short of the amount they applied for, and far below the sum that was actually spent on training in the islands last year. Well, that doesn't look too good. On the surface, the new setup in the Highlands and Islands involves 10 more new undemocratic quangos, added to the surfeit of public bodies that we had before. This seems to necessitate a substantial increase in the resources taken up by administration, and therefore the strong possibility of fewer resources being made available for training and development, etc. Although there is a considerable scepticism about the new setup in the Highlands, everyone is supportive and hoping that it will prove successful. isolation. Meantime, the Crafters' Commission is left in a state of uncoordinated isolation, as before, and lacking the power to do anything practical to arrest the population and decline in crofting in the deprived crofting areas. At the outset, the Crofters' Commission relied on the business and industrial communities to make up their own deficiency in economic development powers. But very quickly they had to admit that they had no hope, their own quotation in one of the reports, no hope of an upsurge of new employment, unquote, from that quarter. And therefore they declared, again, I quote, "We must press on with rationalization of crofting agriculture without waiting for assistance from the business and industrial communities." You'll find that in the annual report again of 1959. In pursuit of their policy of rationalization, which meant the amalgamation of crofts and the reorganization of crofting townships, the Commission alarmed the whole crofting community with their sweeping statements attacking the crofter's security of tenure. Security of tenure has frozen crofting agriculture in an outdated pattern of minute units. That's a quotation again from that report. Security of tenure has frozen crofting agriculture in an outdated pattern of minute units. Unquote. And then they went on to say, and I quote again, "If we are given the necessary auxiliary powers, we shall be undertaking a drastic reduction in the number of croft homes, which may entail a reduction in the population." Unquote. That is an amazing statement by the Crofter Commission, which was set up to help crofting. They were going to interfere with the security of tenure and going to reduce the population and the homes. I don't know what they were thinking of. Now, realizing that the commission, which was set up to help crofting, was in fact threatening to restrict and harden security of tenure and reduce the population and number of croft homes, the whole crofting community from Shetland to Tyree set about organizing themselves into small regional crofters' unions in order to protect their interests. Backing down, back down. Soon the commission was forced to back down. And that was the end of their rationalization policies. It amounted to an acknowledgement that the Commission had failed to regenerate crofting either by relying on a private sector for an upsurge of new employment or by rationalising crofting agriculture. The only function left to the Commission by their restricted remit was, I quote, to regulate crofting. That was their only function, meaningful function. Unquote. That is what they have been doing ever since then, as was acknowledged by the Commission's consultative paper of 1990 called Future Strategy. In that paper, they say at paragraph 4.4, and I quote, "The bulk of the Commission's resources are directed to regulatory work, with the balance largely going on promotional activities." So, unquote, there it is. We do not doubt the necessity to regulate crofting through such administration tasks as croft assignations, apportionment, and a variety of other and doubtless necessary tasks. But what about the human factor? No crofter can live off a few sheep on a 5-acre, well-regulated croft. no matter how well regulated. There are numerous abandoned crofts in park and similar deprived crofting areas which are well and truly regulated, but the crofting tenants are scattered throughout the industrial areas of our country and further afield, seeking the necessary employment which is not available for them in their native homeland. During the 35 years since the Crofter Commission was set up, the population of Park has dropped from 1,145 to 429, of which a high proportion are retired citizens. Yet the complacent crofters document, called Future Strategy, concludes with a triumphant declaration, I quote, "Crofting enters the 1990s in good heart," end quote. I don't know on earth how they can write that. We maintain that the Crofter Commission, as it is at present constituted, failed to measure up to the real needs of the crofting community, and it therefore needs a fundamental review of its functions. Now that is the end of four articles. And may I now read, quote, the following comment in a leading article in the Stornoway Gazette, 18, dated 18-591. The heading is The Rise and Fall of Crofting. And I read, "Many islanders will be interested in a series about the rise and fall of a crofting district, the first part of which we published this week. Although the articles deal with the Park District of Lewis, there are many other rural areas in the Western Isles that have suffered from serious depopulation. The author of the articles, Mr. Angus MacLeod of Marybank, is well respected in crofting circles, as his position as honorary president of the Scottish Crofter Union reflects. He rightly points out that many of the communities could revert back to a wilderness unless urgent steps are taken to revive the local economy. Mr. MacLeod says that the key to stabilising a healthy crofting community is sufficient ancillary employment, but in many areas the opportunities have been sadly lacking. Yesterday, Wednesday, the chairman of the Crofters Commission, Mr. Hughie MacLean, commenting on his organisation's strategy for the next decade, described the 1990s as a decade of opportunities and challenges. Unfortunately, for some areas, it has come too late." Unquote. That's the end of the leading article in the Stornoway Gazette, dated 18-591. Thank you. The editor of the Stornoway Gazette tells me that these articles generated a great interest, and people all over the place wrote into the Gazette asking for copies of these articles. Unfortunately, I didn't notice that the people of Park paid very much attention, whether they did or not. None of them ever said a word to me. I think, however, it is a very good thing to make a survey of crofting districts from time to time in order to compare the situation at that time to a situation in the future. And I suppose that is the value of that exercise. It's reasonably accurate. It's quite accurate. I haven't drawn these places personally and made notes. Thank you.